Welcome to The Breezy Breakfast. Today's guest is Dave Robinson, a psychotherapist in Guelph. Dave focuses on men's mental health and is known as the go-to guy for helping guys. As this discussion covers mental health, some of the topics may be triggering to some listeners. Discretion is advised. Today's host is Tanya.
Good morning, everyone. As you know, it is Movember. The goal of Movember is to raise awareness and funds for men's health and well-being. But before we dive into this topic, let us acknowledge that we are on land that is the traditional home of the Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabe, and Adirondack peoples. In Indigenous communities, high rates of suicide are linked to a variety of factors, including the discrimination, community disruption, and the loss of language and culture. Let us remember that a big part of reconciliation involves addressing the disparities in the social determinants of health, promoting a sense of hope, purpose, meaning, and belonging are ways of promoting health and well-being for Indigenous peoples. Our guest today is Dave Robinson. He's a practicing psychotherapist here in Guelph who exclusively serves men. And as Dave says, who better to talk about men's issues than a man with issues? Now, statistically speaking, men are three times as successful as women in completing suicide. Women are more likely to self-harm and to experience suicidal ideation. Dave, why do you think that is?
Thanks, Tanya, for that question. Good morning. Why do I think that is? Well, I think there's a whole host of reasons why that could be the case for men. I think traditionally, I think men keep a lot of what bothers them, what is painful to them inside. And I think there's a, and of course, this is my opinion, right? So I think that there's a social stigma still attached to mental health and well-being for men. And I think a lot of men suffer silently. And I think that in many ways contributes to men seeing, unfortunately, suicide as a way of handling the pain that they haven't been able to deal with themselves. That would be my best guess. But of course, it's situational.
Indeed. I feel like anyone who considers suicide doesn't necessarily want to die, but rather for this pain to stop.
I think that's a fair assessment. I think a lot of men don't know how to reach out for help. I think that's part of it. I think that what ends up happening is it becomes a horrible option for people who believe that they don't have any other options. And and it's a tragic experience for everybody. The people who survive, the person who completes suicide, and unfortunately, the person who chooses to die by suicide.
So you mentioned stigma. I'm thinking that makes me think of such sayings as men don't go to the doctor unless they need to. Boys are taught, boys don't cry, man up, you can do this by yourself.
I think you're bang on. I think, you know, I grew up in a time when big boys don't cry, man up, you throw like a girl. How many other cliches and social stigmas can be tossed at a man or a young boy as he's just, you know, growing into becoming a man, and have that like not affect the way he sees himself? And so, you know, I think a lot of men really like they man up by shutting down, or what's another way of describing it? they bottle things up by hitting the bottle. Like, these are phrases that I use with my clients because it's, they can relate to it. It's like, okay, I get that. And the reason why I think men do a lot of these things is because they just don't, they're looking for suboptimal ways to deal with another problem, right? And so, you know, when we look at, let's say, for example, addiction, take addiction to alcohol, for example, which is a very common one. I think a lot of men are come to me, the men who I work with who are, you know, grappling with their relationship with alcohol or even an addictive substance of some sort, I think are using that substance as a way of, again, managing that pain or trying to solve a problem through another way of, like, through a way that doesn't serve them. So I choose alcohol as an example to mask the pain or to deal with my shame that I haven't been able to talk about, or any other addictive substance. And so what ends up happening is we kind of live in a society, I think, where people look at alcohol as a problem, right? You're an alcoholic, and there's, you know, labels are fine. They serve a purpose for some people, but I think for other people, it can be very limiting in the sense that if I'm addicted to alcohol or if I'm an alcoholic and that is my way of managing my pain, then if you take away how I cope, what am I going to do with the pain? And I don't know whether or not that's ideal. I don't have an opinion one way or another on that. All I know is right now that when men are trying to find suboptimal ways to manage their pain without seeking help, then that's when the problems start. So a good example is one of the narratives, I think, in society for men is that men need to figure things out on their own. And that's, I think, the start of problems for men where, well, okay, if I don't know how to ask for help, and I also have to figure things out on my own in order to be, quote unquote, a man, then what do I do when I don't know what to do? And who do I actually reach out to if I don't know how to reach out? And that translates into so many other areas for men. That was a lot of words. So that made sense.
Oh, I think it makes sense. You brought up the fact that men don't know where to turn, that alcohol perhaps, well, alcohol is a way of dealing with the symptoms. And one thing that comes to mind is perhaps men are finding it more difficult to express, to identify and express such emotions as fear or shame or anger even. What would you say about that?
I mean, that's a really good point. I think a lot of men really struggle with expressing themselves, especially expressing the feelings inside, right? So traditionally, what are we looking for that for in the range of feelings for men that are typically acceptable? Well, an angry man makes sense and a joyful man makes sense, but like, where's room for sadness? Where's room for fear? Where's room for shame? Where's room for grief? I mean, there's so many things that men hold inside. And I think a large part of that is conditioning, but I think also a large part of that is, I don't think there's intentional space for men to be able to really express themselves. So that's number one. Number two is most men don't know how to express themselves. So it's like, I don't know what I'm feeling inside. I don't know how to name what I'm feeling inside because men usually don't have the language to express themselves in a way that makes sense for what's going on inside, if that makes sense. And so what I work with men to do is help them identify, you know, what are you feeling inside? Where are you feeling it inside? And we work with six core feelings that just make it simple for men, right? Mad, glad, sad, scared, shame, guilt. And once men start to figure that out and what that means for them, they can start to learn to expand the range of their expression, which helps them at work. It helps them be a better father, son, partner, brother, friend, you name it.
Okay. One thing that comes to mind immediately is, yeah, as a younger person, I found that it was okay for a female to express sadness, but not anger, and vice versa for men and young men and boys. It was okay for them to be mad, but not to express sadness. Yes, I found that. And for example, just as a personal example, I saw my dad cry exactly one time in his life. And that was after his mother died in a horrifying way. So whereas I have cried many times in my life, and on the other hand, I have transmuted anger into what I thought was more socially acceptable, which is crying, maybe unconsciously.
Are you saying it's socially more acceptable for women to share their tears than for men?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's true. It's a dangerous generalization, and at the same, not dangerous is the wrong word, but it's a cautious generalization. I'll say it that way. Because I think, you know, without getting into too much clinical or psychological terms here, there's primary emotions and secondary emotions, right? So the primary emotion is what I show people, and the secondary emotion is what's underneath. At least that's how I explain it, and that's how I hold that. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is, on the one hand, I will express what's comfortable for me. So if I'm a man, for example, who's comfortable going to my anger because anger is what was accepted when in my, let's say, family system, what I learned, what was acceptable with my friend group, whatever it was growing up, then that's what I would use as my primary to cover up potentially a secondary. So some men who are quick to go to anger are often using anger to cover up the deep grief that they're carrying and they don't know what to do with, and vice versa. So I have some men who will sit in front of me and within minutes start crying. And what I judge in those moments is that, based on experience, men who go quickly to tears are probably covering up anger that they don't know how to express. Right? It's safe for me to emote. It's safe for me to be tearful, but it's not safe for me to be angry. And the problem with that is that we as a society, again, this is my story and the way I hold this, is that we judge anger as anger is bad. Mm-hmm. And anger is not bad. It's completely natural. And it's a feeling that is most definitely needed, from setting boundaries, holding limits, having a clear yes, having a clear no in my life, moving my life forward. Sometimes anger, because all emotions and feelings are in a range, in a continuum of intensity, right? So my anger is my way of helping me set boundaries, helping me define who I am in moments where I have to stand up for myself, as an example. And so what ends up happening is that if I don't express myself, then I lose track of who I am and I lose my voice. And let's say, for example, I grew up in a family system where I didn't have a voice. You're meant to be seen and not heard, or you're meant to be just at the table, not even feeling like you're seen and definitely not heard, right? Like as if you're not even there. And what does a man do with that when he's growing up in a family system like that? Like, how does he express himself? And that's kind of an example of a journey that some men will have. And it's safer for me to be sad than it is to be angry. The next thing I'll say is that I think a large part of what ends up happening is, because there's a stigma associated with anger, I don't think men want to readily identify with their anger. And because of that, they swallow it down. But because I don't swallow it down, like that which does not get expressed gets repressed, right? It still leaks out. It comes out in my behaviors. It comes out in, like, perhaps sarcasm or passive aggressiveness or frankly, addiction. Because what happens is, if I can't express my anger out to other people in a way that's responsible and appropriate to the situation, then I can turn that anger easily on myself. And that's when a lot of problems can start for men. And that's when that cycle of suffering silently can begin, or one of the ways it can begin. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Okay. It seems like the cycle of suffering gets, for lack of a better term, passed on, right? So
it can. Yeah.
It can. Like, because, I mean,
it doesn't apply to everybody, but for the majority, most young boys look at the father figure in a household as a role model. And if that role model then, you know, expresses his anger in an irresponsible way, like, to be clear, anger is not the problem. The behavior associated with anger for some men is most definitely the problem. And so if I grew up in an environment where anger was expressed in a way that, you know, involved punching holes in the wall, beating my spouse, slamming doors, slamming cupboards, throwing things, you name it, as horrible as those things are to even name, then me as a little boy might look at that and go, wow, I'm not going to be anything like that. Or, wow, I guess that's the only way that I can get what I want. And so men grow up and little boys grow up as they're starting to move toward being a man with a narrative like, look, Dad, I'm just like you. Now will you see, hear, love, and respect me? Or look, Dad, I'm nothing like you. Now will you see, hear, love, and respect me? And the problem is, it's in relationship or reaction to a relationship that they had or didn't have with their father and less about themselves. And so a lot of men's core work is really reorienting them to figuring out, who the hell am I as a man? And, you know, I work with a lot of men between the ages of 25 and 65, and even young men wake up in the morning and go, I don't even know who I am, because they've spent so much time trying to be somebody else, right? Managing maybe their parents' expectations that they've lost track of who they are as young men. And the same holds true for older men who've gone through those cycles, have seen many orbits of the sun around the planet, and they're continually holding on to the belief that, you know, my life is defined by fulfilling the expectations of other people, as opposed to pursuing my own goals, dreams, and desires, if that makes sense.
Yes. One thing that comes to mind is that, again, this is based on my experiences with some men, is that they are defined, again, this is a generalization.
Okay.
They are defined by their work primarily. So when downsizing comes along, I'm talking about in the 90s or so, when downsizing comes along and forced retirement comes along, these men have lost their identity. And what do they, that's the time when it might be best to seek help. But instead, they feel anger that they're not going to perhaps express, or they feel guilt. But I also think that shame comes into it. I've lost my job and I'm no good.
Right. Wow. This is such a layered comment and question. To quote Brené Brown, when she does distinction between guilt and shame, guilt in many ways, and this is what I share with my clients, is that guilt is about making a mistake. And so what I will end up doing is giving them sort of a narrative to help them figure this out. So guilt, I've made a mistake. I know better. I'll do better next time. I want to make things right, quote unquote, clean up my mess. Shame, according to Brené Brown and other people, is that shame is, I am a mistake. So what shame is an identity of a wound that I hold inside. It's a belief on some level that, A, I don't measure up, that I'm not valued, that I don't matter, that I'm not lovable, that I'm not smart enough, whatever the story is. But it's something that I carry inside for me. And because of that, what ends up happening is, instead of men seeing shame as a feeling, what they do is they turn it into an identity. And so instead of becoming, as an example, I am a man who feels shame in certain moments, instead, when I identify with my shame, I become a shameful man. And the problem is, when I make a mistake and I believe I'm a shameful man, then I respond rather than from a place of guilt and remorse, I respond from my shame. And shame doesn't leave a lot of options if that's how I'm handling my life. I can't clean up my mess, because that would then admit that I've made a mistake. And I can't do that because I carry too much shame inside of myself. So my options, instead of to clean up my metaphoric mess by making a mistake, is to cover up my mess out of shame. And that's when the hiding and the secrecy and everything else starts to potentially spin out of control for some men. And now I tell one secret or I tell one lie, and now I have to keep doing that over and over and over again. And what does that do to the shame monster inside of me? It just makes him grow more and more. And the voice inside my head is that shame entity, for whatever lack of a better term, or the part of me that holds shame, which is more a better way to look at it. It's a part of me that holds that shame, really just continues to run the show. And it's really because I've identified with that, it's very difficult for me to escape it. And it becomes normalized in my life and habituated in everything I do, right? And it's like, I can go on for hours on this, apparently. Think of it as a wearing glasses, right? So when I'm dealing with my shame and I can feel it as a feeling and let it flow through me and let it be, you know, serve its purpose rather than identify it, it's like I wear my shame glasses. And every time I see something or hear something, it comes through that lens first before I process it. So somebody says something nice to me, yeah, you just want something from me, right? Because my shame inside doesn't believe I'm worth you telling me I'm great. And then the other part is I hide my brilliance and my magnificence as a person or as a human because my shame doesn't allow me the freedom to be able to hold that and express it in a way that other people can see it and I can feel it.
That makes total sense to me. And I wanted to, again, sort of, the first thing that comes to my mind is a family wherein boys, especially, are held to a high academic standard. So what might happen is, you know, you bring home 95% and a father says, wait a minute, where did the other 5% go? So your value is based on what you produce rather than you as a human being. Mm-hmm. So I can see this being a very big problem, and even if parents don't recognize it as one. So what I'd like to kind of jump into or is, what can parents do to help raise confident, healthy boys and teenagers? And that's a big question, I know.
Oh, goodness. Okay, and right after that, we're going to answer what the meaning of life is too, correct? All right, so as a parent, I can say, as a parent, it's a blessing and sometimes a curse to be a parent. I have two magnificent boys, and they are amazing humans, and they test me regularly, and that's a great thing. And I know that there are areas in my life as a parent where I can continue to grow and improve. And I think the greatest gift that we can give to our children and the greatest gift that we can give, frankly, to the planet is the gift of doing our own work as parents. So that's individuals, not just the father, not just the husband, not just the partner, but everybody in the family system is responsible for doing their own personal work and making sure that they're doing what it takes to become the best version of themselves. So they're not parenting unconsciously, because sometimes, and this is what I've learned in my parenting, that I've adopted parenting patterns that affect how I've raised my kids. And so, for example, the focus on being more rules focused, as in like, you must do the right thing, which on, you know, in broad strokes makes a lot of sense. But if doing the right thing involves, this is how I want it done, therefore you will do it this way, then the message is, gee, in order for me to do right things, I must do things the way dad does. And now the more I end up teaching my kids to do the right thing the way I want it, really what I'm doing is they become an extension of me, as opposed to finding their own sense of separateness and individuation. But now let's talk about the implications of that. And I know this one personally, and that is, what happens when I don't know what the right thing to do is? And what happens if I don't have the courage to ask for help? Because, hey, big boys don't cry and men don't ask for help. Now what? Now there's a short step between doing the wrong thing and then suddenly being the wrong thing over time. Because if I'm constantly being reminded, to use your example, of the 5% that I didn't do when 95% of what I did was great, then that is going to slowly erode my sense of who I am, my sense of my fragility in my own sense of self-concept, so that I'm walking away unintentionally, perhaps wounded, and I carry that with me and I take that into my life. So that now when I'm in a job and now everything is about doing the right thing, what about the 5% that I'm not doing? And instead of focusing on all the great things I've done at work, I focus on the 5% that I didn't get right and then never, ever satisfied. And as a leader, that translates into how I treat my people. That translates into the messaging that that I'm expecting from those who work with me. I mean, you can see how it all sort of links, like dominoes or ripple effect of how we are raised and how we could show up as adults.
What about intergenerational roles? For example, the roles that grandparents might play.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What about them? I mean, that's a really tough one because grandparents are so awesome, and yet they're not awesome at times, because sometimes who wants to be the child that rebels against grandma and grandpa? I mean, that's not usually a great thing to be. And on the other hand, how do you separate? Well, this is how we've always done it in our family. So, but what if that, the way we've always done it, isn't evolving? Mm. Right. So where's space for me to make my own decisions within that family system? And that gets back to a rules focused family system, like do the right thing at all costs. But the problem is doing the right thing is not always the honest thing. And so what ends up happening is I end up developing behaviors where I'm doing things for others that I might not want to do. And then, you know, some people refer to it as pleasing. The clinical term is placating, right? It's like, this is what I do. I'm a placator. And then I end up doing all kinds of things for other people and nothing for myself. And that's a recipe for misery. And how do we get to this from grandparents? I have no idea. But, what I want to share is the other type of family system is more nurturing, right? So rather than focus on relationships, it's focused on, rather than focus on rules, it's focused on relationships. And so in that family system, that nurturing family system, whether a child does something right or wrong, it doesn't affect who they are as a human. It doesn't, their wholeness is still seen by the parent, right? So it's okay, Dave, to make a mistake. It's okay to, and it's even better to learn from that mistake. And so Dave learns as he grows up in a nurturing family system that's relationship focused, that here I can make a mistake and be okay. I can make a mistake and not have the desire to cover it up. I can stand in knowing that, hey, you know what? I'm learning, or every opportunity is a learning opportunity, as an example, versus the rules focused family system, which identity is easily wrapped into that, at least from my perspective, in the sense that if I don't do the right thing, there must be something wrong with me. And that doesn't happen in the other one. The other one is more focused on holistic, seeing the human as a whole, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. What comes to my mind is, I think this applies to a lot of relationships, but especially, I'm going to say, spouses. There might be one spouse that doesn't want to have a difficult conversation. So they go to, placating and saying, okay, that's fine. They do what is going to stop the conversation right away, mm-hmm. rather than engaging in a tough conversation that will actually go towards solving mm-hmm. a problem. Mm-hmm. So that's what comes to my mind.
Can I just share what's coming up for me in this? Okay, so you've touched on another point here, and that is with regard to relationships. What do men bring to their relationships? And I think inside every little man, every man is a bunch of little boys that are wounded in some way, something that they haven't been able to deal with, or it's unresolved or whatever. And so sometimes in difficult conversations, if I'm not practiced expressing my feelings, if I don't know how to express myself, if all I'm doing is placating, for example, and not being necessarily honest with my partner or spouse, then my little wounded boy sets up a situation where instead of my partner being a partner, he or she becomes a parent. And now I am in a parent-child dynamic. That's one example. The other is that when I'm in my wounded little boy, sometimes in order for me to be able to be heard, I will move into what I call paradoxically man mode, where I will jump to trying to fix, explain, control, or overpower. And by overpower, I mean just getting bigger and louder to make my point. But the irony is that it's not man mode, that is little wounded boy mode. And so these are the behaviors that I show up in because I don't know what else to do if I'm not practiced at expressing myself, if I don't have a clear sense of who I am as a man, and if I'm not boundaried, and like there's all these related elements that contribute to those moments. And the sad thing is, and this is how I hold it anyway, relationships either evolve or they dissolve. So if you have one partner who's really committed to doing their personal work and the other one isn't, that's not going to go so well. Really, there needs to be, in my, at least this is how I see it, there needs to be a mutual understanding to build this satisfying relationship. Both partners need to be committed to doing their own work, right?
Right. We do have a question.
Here?
Yes, we do. The first one is from Juanita, and then the second one is from Ron.
Hi, everybody. I've been thinking a lot about this over the last, you know, my life, but especially the last few years. The role, how much absolute gender roles play in how people end up with mental health issues. I'll give you a personal example. Someone I love, I think 11, when his parents split up, was told he had to look after the family now because he was the man of the house. Which, interestingly, if there were problems with anybody in the family, he felt responsible and still does. And it's awful because stuff happens to people. But thinking about the idea of anger and sadness and how certain things were expected of one gender or the other. And one of the things I love about people questioning their gender in these times is that they can look at themselves as whole people. At least that's the way I see it, that instead of being a man, so you do this, and a woman, so you do this. And I think it also is different in different families what that role is. But when you grow up with those ideas, it's really hard to look at yourself as a whole person, and that causes problems.
Sorry, I'm unclear, Juanita. What was the question that you're asking?
How much does that come up in your practice, I guess? How much do you talk about how being a whole person can really looking at all the different, like you talked about looking at all the different feelings. Do you ever get explicit about it being okay to be not one absolute package?
And just to frame that a little bit differently, we did have a question earlier about looking into the feminine, sort of like back in the 80s. So with moving into where we have much more non-binary and transgender people, how are you seeing that show up in your practice?
Wow. Okay. So this is such a layered and nuanced question because it has so many different implications in my mind. And I think in a lot of ways, it's very situationally specific. So there are some clients that I have who have children who are going through transitions. So they're experiencing gender fluidity, or they're exploring becoming trans in some way, shape, or form. And how does that affect their relationship? And so there's lots of work around acceptance and to an extent, forgiveness, because some men really don't know what to do with the feelings that they have about their own children related to how they're expressing themselves. So not only do I need to sense to get a sense of who I am, accept who I am, I need to forgive myself. Then I need to take a look at how I can take self-responsibility for how I show up in the world, and then start to take care of myself and model that for my family and my friends and everybody else around me. And then look to how I contribute to the world, self-actualization as an example. So yes, I know I'm skirting the issue, but I mean, I'm trying also not to make this necessarily about gender, but more so about roles, because I agree with that. So there are lots of guys who have situations where there's a specific role that they learned in how they were raised. Fathers go out and, believe it or not, and still go out and earn money and come back home and expect to be served and have dinner on the table. And, you know, how come dinner is not on the table? That must mean I'm not loved or appreciated. Don't you understand how much I'm working and how hard I'm working? Well, you know, like there's all kinds of narrative and rationalization around that. On the other hand, roles have reversed. There's lots of incredible women out there making an incredible difference in the world, taking on roles of senior leadership and doing all kinds of things and blazing new trails and opportunities for more and more women as time goes on. And I think men in a lot of ways struggle with how to accept that. And how do we as men navigate in that world so that there's more equanimity as much as there can be, at least at this stage, and do so in a way where they're not losing their own sense of self in this. Like, okay, so maybe I'll just go back home and take on the role of being the mother or you know, like, oh my goodness, some of the things that I've heard, it's like, really? No, you're doing this. This is the role that you've taken on. It's not anything to do with being a mother or a father. It's how you are contributing to your household, as an example.
I'll just throw out, I do recognize so many, especially younger men, but other older men have been really working hard at becoming better parents instead of assuming that the mother has to do all that kind of stuff.
So I ended up coming out as non-binary as a process of helping my child navigate their gender and recognize that a lot of the things that I was trying to help them with and open them up with ended up being like, oh, wait a minute. Now I'm asking those questions of myself and realized that, oh yeah, like the way that the traditional gender roles have kind of affected me in my life is I kind of felt like, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Men in Black, Vincent D'Onofrio in the alien suit, like that was me trying to be man, right? Like it was me, like didn't fit into it, right? And it caused a whole lot of turmoil in my life. And what I found was when I finally came out as a non-binary, as much as it was scary and slow and difficult, immediately the first thing that happened was this huge boulder of male gender expectations just fell off my shoulders. The behaviors didn't go anywhere. All the inculcated things that I picked up over my life that I thought I was supposed to do and I like be like practiced in, like all of that stayed. Mm-hmm. But there was this freedom suddenly. Beautiful. And not only that, the thing that I found was that those male expectations were a prison. And it did not serve me in any way, shape, or form, except to create more mental health problems for myself. And I'm a single parent, right? Like I'm doing all the roles, right? Like, and it's one of those things where it's like, for me, washing dishes is enjoyable. Cooking is enjoyable. These things are enjoyable, but I would never have let myself enjoy those things before.
Right. I love that. Thank you for saying that, because there's so many, can I ask your name? Kevin. Thank you, Kevin. Kevin, what I really love about that is the modeling that I judge that you're showing your child and what that means to be a human in the household, and just the way in which you are navigating the world right now without those expectations. And I just felt that sense of freedom that I want for so many of my clients to experience. I'm not suggesting they need to be non-binary, but I am suggesting that what is possible is that that level of freedom as a man exists as soon as I begin to do the work. Because when, you know, a lot of clients who may be listening to this or who've heard me speak before know that when a new person comes to my practice, one of the things that I say is thank you, which may sound trite, but my perspective is this: not enough men, in my judgment, are doing their own work. And so any man who chooses to do his work, I think contributes, oh man, this is really hitting me deep, contributes to making the world safer for women, children, and other men. And so I think it's a blessing every time a man comes through my door who I've never met before, and they're committed to trying to figure out their life in a better way. And 100%. And it may take time. They may need to take the boulder and put it on the ground and chop it into tiny bits first before they can remove it, you know, and then scoop it up and then put it in a trash can and then take that trash can to the recycling bin and then drive that recycling bin to another country. Like, who knows what it is? But there's layers upon layers upon layers that men have to go through sometimes in order to get to resolution. And that's what I see my role as, is that man that holds that space for them to be able to do that unapologetically.
We're going to let this conversation go one more round, and then we've got to get onto some other stuff.
I'll just say the one thing that I found that it also does is it changed my perception of the women around me. Mm-hmm. Now, I grew up in a female household, so I had all of these female behaviors that I judged and suppressed. But all of a sudden, I had this ability to now see from a different perspective, and that allowed for me to see the women around me, not through the lens of the male gaze, but through the lens of just humanity. And then also understand that humanity in myself. Got and it. Understand that combination actually made me a fuller person.
Thank you so much, Kevin. And just, I was someone that was raised in a household that was non-gendered. Everybody just did the chores. Like, you got up at 6 o'clock in the morning if you wanted the good chores, and if you wanted to sleep in, you got the crappy chores. And that's just the way it was. My brother actually taught his wife how to do laundry after they got married. And we have a question from the audience here. We're going to go to Ron East.
Hi. I'd like to get your response to how men react to post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, so I work with a lot of first responders and men in service. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress, is a challenge. You're asking me how men respond to it. And I think it's very situational and case specific. Some men wake up, you know, with nightmares covered in sweat, and some men can't leave the house, and some men become dysregulated with their emotions. I mean, it all depends on what happens. And without getting into too much psychology around it, I think it really boils down to what the event was that is carried in the nervous system and in that particular person, and how it presents. Sorry, that seems like such a lame answer, but I don't want to make any judgments about somebody I don't know.
I worked in addiction treatment, and we had a few individuals that were actually members of the military. And one of the individuals, part of his PTSD, he was unable to sleep in a room with someone else. He had to be on his own, which when you're trying to get through addiction is counterintuitive. So it really is very individualistic as far as how each individual person, regardless of how they present to the world, deals with PTSD.
Good morning. Simple question. What's your response to the expression, whatever doesn't kill you make you stronger?
Yeah, wow. I guess that's like falls in the realm of no pain, no gain. But the problem with that is that there's always pain, right? Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You know, I think it's a great, I don't know. It feels a bit platitude-y to me, because I'm not so sure I agree with that. I think that is probably one of the thoughts that permeates in culture for men that hold a lot of their pain inside. What if I'm not strong? Then what? What are my options? What if I've been growing up and raised in an environment where I've told I've been weak, and that all of who I am, depending on the spectrum of who I am as a human and how I express myself, how does that give me range of expression to be who I am? And what if I'm not built like a typical man? What if I'm physically not as strong as some of the guys? Where does that leave me? That's why comments like that, I think, can be destructive for some men. And I think it feeds the cliche in many ways that men have to be tough. You know, you have to man up. There's no room for softness. Men have to be hard. Men have to be edgy. Men have to be all these things. And my response to that is, I believe men are more present if they're allowed to be fully who they are and not a construct that other people expect them to be.
So would you say perhaps that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger as long as you work through the stuff that isn't killing you?
Okay, so if you're going to do it with help, then that's a different story. If you're going to get support, if you're going to be resourced, yes, 100%, because that can inevitably make me stronger in the sense of being able to get the resources that I need, to be able to ask for help, to be okay with being imperfect, and to be okay with being vulnerable. But that's not to say you're giving up your masculinity, right? Like, we talked about this in our pre-talk around the concept of toxic masculinity. And when you said that to me, Tanya, I went, grr, I hate that term. And the reason why, and hate's a strong word, but in this case, I'll hold on to it, because I don't believe masculinity is toxic. I believe certain behaviors that men have are toxic, but that doesn't mean masculinity as a concept is toxic, because there's still room for men to be masculine, to be, you know, forceful, to be that wild man, to be that virile man, to be that sexual man, to be like all these things. Like, you know, being soft doesn't mean all that goes away. It just means I'm more integrated as a human and perhaps as a man.
Excellent. I'm glad you touched on that. Mm-hmm. We have one more question.
Yes, we have a new person asking a question, and this person's name is Brian. Brian, come on up.
Hi, thank you for including me today. My wife and I are usually here on Thursdays, and we always appreciate the discourse. So to the organizers, thank you. And my question to you is, it's about screen time. And there's been a lot of studies done with youth and screen time and whatnot, but have there been any studies done with older generations with screen time? And if so, what do they say, and what are your opinions on that?
Interesting idea, especially as we move into Gen Alpha, and they are basically born with screens in their hands.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you, Brian, for this question. Screen time. Here's what I will say about some of the clients that I work with, and that is that some of the men, even, you know, into their 30s and 40s, are now using gaming as a form of escape. And so, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s even, or, you know, and I'm not suggesting that playing video games and being on screens is necessarily a bad thing. But if I'm a man who grew up and playing was not something that I was ever allowed to do, or that I never really understood how to have fun and how to play, then this experience of getting involved in, let's say, video games, I could easily take that into a whole new level where I disappear from my life. And as a man gets older, his responsibilities tend to get more and more, tend to increase. And so, you know, there's a problematic relationship there that could emerge. And again, it depends on the man and it depends on the situation. So
this is a very general opinionated answer, not a clinical one, to be clear. Oh, sorry, Brian, I wish I could give you more there, man.
I just wanted to make a quick comment and then we'll go to Erin Keaton.
Okay.
She's online. When you said that perhaps boys aren't encouraged to play outside, part of me thinks that this is a result of the increased safetyism that we find in our society, whereas the risk of getting hurt, physically hurt, with roughhousing or the like, is then totally discouraged. So then boys turn to video games. The other comment I'd like to make is that video games, and I'm going to also say porn, encourages men to not engage with other people and not be in the real world. And that's not good for anybody.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're talking about dopamine hits, I think, in a lot of ways, right? So it's like I'm getting this temporary fix that I need because the world is so overstimulating. I don't know what to do. I'm not equipped to be able to speak and get my state my needs as a man. I don't know, you know, how to communicate what's going on inside. And therefore, I go to whatever substance, whatever game, whatever, you know, porn site, whatever it is that I need to do to act out what's going on inside. And the challenge is, it does, I think, erode a man's ability to stay present in his life. And I think when there's that kind of reinforcement, that kind of temporary feeling good, then it's really easy to want to feel good like that when it's not easy to feel good about the way the world is right now. A lot of guys think they have to figure all this out on their own. And that is such a not a true statement. And I just wish men would let that go and find a different way to think about things. Like, it's okay to figure things out with other people. It's, you know, being alone is just, it's not a recipe for long-term success or satisfaction.
Agreed. We are a social species. Now I'd like to turn the mic, metaphorical mic, to Erin Keaton. Erin.
When you're answering the question about what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I very much agreed with how you answered that, because in my, I'm a cancer survivor, and I think like whatever doesn't kill you gives you trauma, right? And being able to work through that trauma and having the ability to feel your feelings, regardless of any kind of gender roles imposed on you, is huge. And I think that men get completely the short end of the stick when it comes to that because of the traditional stereotypes that we impose on men as per behavior and what you have to work through and things like that. And I saw it with my father and my daughter's dad when he had testicular cancer. So like, it's really, really poignant to say that you can have feelings and be not okay.
It's amazing how many men are conditioned to suck up their tears as soon as they start to get watery eyes. And the way I express it in, you know, in my practice with men is, you know, tears are just a truth response. They're just an involuntary experience that shows that I've touched a deeper truth, and my eyes are watering as a result of that. And, you know, and what I really appreciate what you said, Erin, is that it's okay to be not okay. And not a lot of people don't get that, especially guys. It's like, especially if I've been conditioned to think I need to fix things and I can't fix me by myself. I mean, yike, what do I do with that? And so the first thing to understand is it's okay to not feel okay, as long as you're sharing not feeling okay with somebody and you're not sitting there not feeling okay and not doing anything about it. Because half the time, just walking through the door into a therapist's office is the work, just going through the threshold. Because really, look at it this way, it's almost like an initiation. It's that threshold of transformation when you walk through the doorway into that liminal space between the world that I'm in pain, into the therapy office. That's a whole transition right there. And I think not a lot of people, I think, really understand that. And just doing that is work. And then being practiced at arriving and keeping appointments and looking after myself and valuing self-care in a way that's socially acceptable now, but also reflects my degree of self-love and wanting to improve, I think is so important. And it all starts with the comment, I believe, that you shared, Aaron, and that is, it's okay to be not okay, and giving permission to just be them instead of, oh, don't cry. You know, why are you so angry? You know, you want to smile more. You know what? To them, I say, no, sorry, I can't swear, can I? That's, you got the sense of what it was that I was going to say, because, you know, like, screw you. I can be who I am. I don't have to be the way you want me to be.
I agree. Therapy shouldn't be an insult, because when I had cancer, first thing I did was get a therapist. And it was lovely, right? To have someone who's sitting there dedicated to, like, hearing all of what's going on in your head. I think that reframing that as a strength, you know, reaching out and getting help, it's important.
Thank you. And if I could just say one thing, I know we have a bunch of other questions, but if there's one other thing, just to put this into some sort of metaphor. So in my practice, one of the things that I do with men is I have my hand. This is Dave's mirror. So my work, I think, in a lot of ways, along with holding space and just being there in a non-judgmental and totally accepting place for men, is to reflect back to them who they are in these moments. And so some men come into the clinic and they know there's a mirror in the room and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And then some men come into the clinic and they go, okay, I'm willing to accept the fact that there's a mirror here. And then some men come in and go, okay, I've accepted the fact there's a mirror here. I'm actually now putting the mirror in front of me, but I'm not looking at it. And then the work is to look at the mirror eventually, and then eventually look in that mirror and go, damn, I really love the guy in the mirror, you know? And I think when men can do that, like, there's so much freedom that can come from that, that place of looking at that man in the mirror and going, oh, I love you. You're so magnificent. You're amazing. And you can say that to yourself and not sound like you're repeating some sort of affirmation tape from the 80s or, you know, something on Spotify. Really, that it's coming from a truthfully organic place. And yeah, there you go.
Thank you, Aaron. I'd like to go to another question in the chat. Please differentiate alone and loneliness. For example, I like being alone, but I hate being lonely.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so human beings are like, we exist on a continuum of community and connection and individualism and separateness. And I think in any extreme, neither one of these are great. So for example, too much connection is, you know, can come off as needy and attached, like needing to be attached to people. And too much loneliness aloneness can lead to isolation and therefore loneliness. So I think the difference between being alone, because I love solitude, I love filling my cup up by quiet time and meditation and walking through the forest and walking my dog. I mean, that's how I fill my cup up. And so, but if all I'm doing is being on my own, then it's pretty easy for me to feel lonely. And I think a large part of, I'll just own my own sense of loneliness. Like, I can feel lonely in a crowd at times. And the reason why that happens is because sometimes I just don't know how to create connection. And there's a lot of guys that are like that. I mean, you know, I'm a therapist. I work with men, and there are still moments where I go, okay, I don't know what to say. What do I do here? How do I create a connection with this person? I do this for a living. What does it matter with me? And I just want to run away. And so, you know, there are moments where, like, I can feel that loneliness because I don't know how to create connection. And creating connection is a human need. Like, we need what I call TLC. We need touch, we need love, and we need connection. And those three things, if they're not in our lives, can feed loneliness, it can feed misery, it can feed all kinds of things. I hope that helped.
We are going to Warren for a question. I think he might have to come up.
Hey, Dave, just a fabulous presentation. And he opened up a lot of doors. So my question is, based on what you've told us today, the importance of a role model. Mm. And if you don't have a role model, what happens?
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, having lived overseas in a different environment, different nationality. The upbringing of Asian boys in an Asian family may have changed now, but when I was there growing up, the importance of that boy being the dominant in the family. And it was helped a lot, too, because of the decision to have one child must be a male growing up there. And so today in your business, do you have a lot of different nationalities that come in to see you?
Yeah, I am blessed with a great deal of diversity, not only in age, but also in culture and in my practice. And so the nuances of how culture treats specific things that we in North America, in quote unquote, a dominant culture, see and view life is so different. And yet what's not different is the phrase that I have is pain doesn't have any borders, right? I have pain and it connects me to other men who have pain. And culture defines how we manage that pain in some ways, and what is acceptable behavior culturally and what isn't. And sometimes what is acceptable in certain cultures doesn't necessarily fit in my culture. And so my job as a therapist, as I see it, is to hold the space no matter who it is, because underneath it all is the pain. And I think when I'm able to, as a man, access that and find ways to deal with it, then it doesn't matter where I am culturally, I can be okay with who I am and figure out how to navigate what works for me and what doesn't. So I will say this, a lot of guys that I do work with from different cultures are in a place now where they're looking at their culture doing one of two things. This no longer resonates for me. And so there's this acculturative stress that they carry with them to go, I really want to be more, for lack of a better term, North American or Canadian, and less whatever my culture of origin is. On the other hand, there are men who are part of this culture and want to return back to their original culture, and both carry with them strain and associated stressors. So, like, you know, I wish there was a real clear answer to this question, because it's an important one. To answer the question specifically about my practice, yes, I have lots of culturally diverse men. Lots. I have a fair share, let's call it that. And I think that the underpinning of everything that holds us together in some ways is the pain that we carry, as in this case, men, because that's my practice. And what I think is really important too, to add to this, is just because I'm feeling pain doesn't mean I am my pain. And when I can help a man figure that out, that's the first step in realizing that there's other options other than to suffer. I hope that answered your question.
I think that Warren also asked about role models.
Yeah, I tried to steer clear of that one. That didn't work, did it? Yeah, you know, it's so hard for me to make a comment about this, because unless I know the person and I understand the nuances and the history, it's difficult for me to answer that question with any kind of an insight or value, I think. So I steered clear of that intentionally around, you know, culture and dominance and those questions, because it really depends. And I know, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. It depends on who's in front of me and what their story is, because everybody has a different origin story. And we express our origin stories, I think, in different ways, depending on, you know, the degree of freedom that we have around being who we are.
Okay, Morgan.
So we've talked a lot about your individual therapy practice. I have a friend that is part of a men's group. And over the last year, I have seen him change dramatically. I asked him to provide me with sort of the basis of what his men's group is. And I'm going to read to you what it is that he sent back to me. And I'd love to hear your comments on it. So in his men's group here in Guelph, they do not give advice. They create space where men can be masked down.
and express themselves freely. They have men discover their purpose, as well as the obstacles in the way of becoming that man. And they help men dissolve the obstacles and support them on their path. Does this sound like something that would be beneficial for other individuals struggling to learn how to be their best selves?
I can't express enough the importance of men finding community, because one of the things, well, I'll share that I've been involved in men's work in men's communities for over 20 years now. And I started in a men's group. All I remember one day was a person who's very near and dear to me invited me to his men's group in Toronto. And I remember walking into a room, in my mind, there's about 20 guys that are all sitting on the floor. And it's a Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. And the first thought I had was, what the hell did I get myself into? And then I noticed that in that room, there are like two tackle dummies, you know, these football tackle dummies. And next thing I know, like 20 minutes later in this circle of men, I'm standing and I'm just hammering this tackle dummy, like hitting it and just raging on this thing in a way that's really safe and responsible. And then the next thing I know, I collapse on the floor in a pile of tears. And that was my intro into men's group. And it's been that way. Well, not that way, but it's been an important part of my life for the last 20 years. And I'm part of an international men's organization that has owned close to 100,000 men now that are part of it. And we do men's groups. We invite men to sit in what we call circle. And I think the biggest byproduct, not only of a men's group, a peer-to-peer support group, is the sense that when men are sitting in a circle, they don't feel alone. They can get a sense of, oh, wow, I'm not the only one that feels that way. And, you know, that to me, I think is really critical, because when I know I'm not alone in my pain, then all of a sudden now I have the freedom to share more. And eventually what ends up happening is, especially in an environment that's non-judgmental and non-opinionated and nobody fixes another person, right? Like, that is so critical. And so there's different groups. I would encourage any man to go and check out different groups, because different groups have different approaches, and some are full range and some are very contracted in the way in which they operate. But ultimately, there's no downside, I think, to a group, from a peer-to-peer support group. I also would highly recommend a therapeutic group where the facilitation is led by a therapist, and there's lots of opportunity there for men to also go deeper in their work and then take that work into their own individual work with their therapist. Endorse that more. I think it's really important.
So just before we go to our final question from the restaurant, I've heard you say the word fix things.
Yeah.
And that is something that I have noticed. When there's a problem, many men feel that it is their job to fix things on their own. But this is not necessarily a healthy way to go about things. It's okay to recognize that there's a problem, and you can be amongst a group that attacks the problem. Okay, that's my comment. We have a question from Juanita.
Hi again. It's probably more of a comment, but I was just thinking about the role model question. And when you talked about community, as a single mom raising a boy, one of the things I thought a lot about is trying to have men around that I thought were good role models. I think the idea of men building community with other men is also a way to change their ideas of what the one way of being a man is. So I think that's the end of my comment.
Thanks so much, Juanita. And I'm just going to do a little plug for a guy that I've found online that has really helped me to see how men have been taught. His name is Cyzor. It's C-Y-Z-O-R. And he just provides some real, hey guys, this is what the women want. And the stuff that you've been taught, it's all wrong.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming here today. I think I speak for all of us when I say that I appreciate your words of wisdom.
Thank you, Tanya. It's truly been a pleasure and an opportunity. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to speak to everybody here online and in the restaurant related to what I judge to be one of the most, like, a more important conversation around opening up dialogue for men around health and well-being and mental health and well-being and general health and well-being. So thank you for this opportunity. It's been an honor. My counseling practice is shiftcounseling.ca. You can check out that if you want to visit my website. Alternatively, david@shiftcounseling.ca. And yeah, I see you like my tagline, helping men get their shift together. Yep, that's essentially what we do. Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to our announcements. There is a council planning meeting on Tuesday, the 28th of November, starting at 6:30 p.m. The items up for discussion are gender-based and or intimate partner violence and encampments downtown. Please Google ERO Greenbelt 2023 about Bill 136. Please comment by Thursday, November the 30th. I can't stress enough how important this is because just recently our premier said that people don't really care about the Greenbelt. So let's let him know that we do. And next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're going to be talking about food security in Guelph. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you, Dave. And thank you all for coming here today. See you next week.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis, it's important to get help and talk to someone. The Connects Ontario Helpline provides free and confidential health services information for people experiencing problems with alcohol and drugs, mental illness, or gambling. Their toll-free number is 1-866-531-2600. That's all for this week. Music is Tranquility by Jules Germ, and the podcast is produced by Scotty Hertz. Breezy Breakfast is heard Mondays at 9 a.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM, and all are welcome to attend in person Thursday mornings at 8 a.m. at the Rise and Shine Restaurant, 44 Macdonnell Street in downtown Guelph.